I'm out of these books, Chelsea, since it's your baby.
Sure. Again, I was in a master's program, so I was fortunate enough. I was at Pacific Northwest College of Art, and I was fortunate enough to have faculty around designers who were really supportive and critiqued me along this process. It was really important to me to make it pretty comprehensive. I knew from the bat I wanted to include interviews. So each one is opened up with an interview between myself and one of the Fisher poets who contributed to that particular chapbook or volume. And then I also wanted to incorporate my illustrations. And I didn't know, originally I thought maybe I could do one illustration for every poem, and that was just way too overwhelming. That was not gonna happen. And as we started collecting all the work, it became apparent that there were specific themes that were emerging, and just being able to kind of collect these different themes and all the work and kind of separate them into these themes created that idea of separating them out and being able to do covers. And that made it a lot more manageable for the artwork. If we did covers, it could kind of showcase the artwork on the front and then all the work inside.
So. Right. And the we came somewhere along the line, we came up with the idea of titling each volume from a piece within that volume. And so the seven books are Mending Holes, which is about the history of commercial fishing, For the Love of Fish, which is about the love and hate of our work, and you know, there are times when we don't particularly like it, and there are times when we wouldn't be anywhere else in the world. Illusions of Separateness is about politics and the environment. Gathering is about community. Family Dynamic is about the family issues that commercial fishing puts on folks. Making Waves is about women. And then we just recently changed the title of the survival and risk issue from Overboard to Every Boat Has a Wave. And so that's the seven books. And as we started dividing them, and then Chelsea came up with these covers, the covers are just, they fit like a glove, and it's working really well. And if anybody would like to see the covers, they can go to www.inthetote.com, and there's a link on the welcome page to go to this project, and I have all the covers up on that site, so they can actually see how beautiful they are.
It's a very interesting website just on its own.
Oh,
also.
Thank you.
Yeah. Which is all about the Fisher poets.
It's our online archive of Fisher poetry and Fisher poet work. And so we've got audio, video, and written work of everybody. And also on that page about the anthology, there are samples from the books. And so a sample from each mm-hmm. book. And so people can read what they would be, something along the lines of what they would be getting.
There's great bios about all the Fisher poets on there as well. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of learn about all the people who've contributed to the books and their own backgrounds.
Yeah. Right. And at the end of each volume, the bios are lovely, and the photographs with the bios also gives it a human touch at the end of each volume.
Yeah.
And since we mentioned the Fisher Poet Celebration, it just happened. Anything you want to say about this year's celebration that just happened in Astoria?
Well, it was fantastic.
Yeah, I think I've been going since the second one. I discovered it in 1999, which was the second year. Fell in love with it, and I've been back every year since. And like you introduced me, I'm part of the organizing committee now, and I pretty much do the social media and the web presence. And I think this one was the best ever. The quality of the work, the venues were all very respectful of the poets and the readers. And I should say that it isn't all just poetry. There's songs and musicians who come and play. There are also songs in the books, and there's a lot of good prose stories that people tell and tell very well. So it's a wide variety of not only not only just literature, but it's we have folks writing in the anthology and who come to Fisher Poets from as far away as Japan and New England. There were four or five people from New England. We had a poet and her companion who was recording for the BBC, who came from the north coast of the UK, and we have we've had folks come from Scotland. We've so it's a real international event, and it was, and this year it was too, and it was really spectacular. It was a very, very good weekend.
And how many venues are there now?
I think there were six this year.
Yeah.
And yeah, so on any given night that you attend, you can only see about a sixth of what's going on, but there's a lot of choices, and that's, I think that's the beauty of it. So the Astoria really turns itself inside out for us, and it's really good to see.
And speaking of choice, you mentioned one of the parts of your choice process was to include everybody who did apply to be in these books. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And what were the other challenges about how to narrow this down?
Well, one of the challenges was try to get the books of equal length, and they're all in the 50 to, I think the longest book is 59 pages and the shortest is 51. The history volume isn't quite done yet, and it was in the high 40s, but I think we're going to end up with it in the 50s. So, but trying to pigeonhole the works into the volumes that we created, I think, was a challenge.
Yeah.
And I think we've done a reasonable job of that.
I think too, along with that, it was kind of a blessing and a challenge. So a lot of the work spans many of those themes. So we were able to, if one was thinner than another, we were able to kind of mine some of those from one theme and move it to another one, but it was hard to find out where they fit the best. So that was a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
Pat Dixon, you have some contributions in these volumes, and one of them is in the volume that is currently called Overboard, but it's changing. And
right.
Tell me again what it's changing to.
It's a title of a poem by Gino Leach called "Every Boat Has a Wave."
But you have a contribution called Overboard in that volume, and maybe we could hear that now.
Sure, I'd be delighted. Overboard. It was a cannery truck, after all, we said afterward. Unreliable. It stalled when he would bring it to a complete stop. He probably coasted through the stop sign. Bone cancer doesn't relent, the doctors told her. Go, live, enjoy the time you have left. For 5 years, she did exactly that. Dove the Great Barrier Reef, went to China, fished the lake near her house with her niece. When she was done, she slipped away overnight. It doesn't take much. A gentle roll of the boat as the wake passes underneath, the brush of an elbow, and the power drill, set too close to the edge, tips and tumbles overboard. You see it roll, watch without moving, frozen like a dream is materialized before you. It doesn't even complete a full circle before it hits the water, that flashlight or 10-inch crescent wrench, or your cell phone, slipping out of your pocket as you bend down in the air before you know it. It lands on the water's surface like you land on the bed after a long day, blankets fluffing, rising as they are displaced, absorbing the impact and falling back again. Only the water receives and moves aside, and you see your knife, the one you spent all those seasons sharpening, the one you got in France years ago, on vacation, a gift from the vendor who loved that you were a fisherman and insisted you take it, suddenly out of reach, beneath the surface, fading, getting smaller and dimmer as it recedes from you and all your memories of it, out of your grasp forever in an instant. Like your friend who tipped over the edge after the long struggle to hang on to the rail while the disease rolled under her, or the buddy who was brushed away in the morning light when a car crested the hill and elbowed him into the air before he knew it. A short fall into deep water.
Thank you for reading that. And I imagine every fisherman has an overboard story of some kind.
Pretty much, yeah. I fished Cook Inlet in Alaska for 20 years, and unfortunately, the person that that's in that poem was also a fisherman, and who was actually chasing down a part for his boat when he coasted through a stop sign. And yeah, but I think pretty much everyone has that story. Yeah.
And that volume would point up all the dangers of fishing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the risk and survival, and some that are not about, you know, that don't survive. So yeah, it pretty well covers all the bases.
Yeah, and For the Love of Fish is another one of those themes that talks about, in spite of all that risk, there's still that drive to go out every season, every day of the season, and do the work that you love.
Mm. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. It's powerful stuff.
I'm speaking with Chelsea Stephen. She is a freelance illustrator living in Portland, and also with Patrick Dixon. This is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. Patrick Dixon is a writer, photographer, and Fisher poet. We just heard him reading one of his poems. And we're talking about their joint project, the Fisher Poets Anthology, Anchored in Deep Water. At the beginning, I mentioned that this project is currently waiting on funding from a Kickstarter campaign to go to press. Can you talk about that, what that's about?
So... up until now, we've been printing and binding all of these copies that we have by hand. I'm fortunate enough to have some of these resources available where I can print. We've gotten our paper from a local paper company here, Kelly Paper, and it's expensive. There's no way that we would be able to print all of these one off and make it economically feasible. So we're asking for help in just the printing and the distribution costs.
Right. And the Kickstarter campaign is basically waiting on a video that we were working on just yesterday to putting the final piece of recording on. So we've got to do a little bit of editing. And then we're all set to go. We'll post that video and launch the campaign, hopefully by the middle, maybe the end of next week. And our goal is $10,000 to print 2,100 books and the boxes that go in them, and then distribute them to people who pledge. And if folks would like to be notified about that, they can check in the tote.com. They can check the Fisher Poets Gathering page on Facebook. And then there's also a page called the fisherpoets.org, www.fisherpoets.org. And announcements will be made on all those pages to let folks know that the Kickstarter campaign's up and running. And once they pledge, we have pledge levels from $10 all the way up to $1,000. And for each pledge, you get a reward. And so $10 gets you a book of your choice out of the set of seven. $70 gets you a box set. And then Chelsea's offered to make 11 by 14 fine art prints of any of the covers and or all of the covers. If you pledge at the highest level, you get all of them, and they're all mounted as an encaustic print on wood. So that'll all be posted on Kickstarter, and basically we don't get any of the money. It goes into account and gets held by Amazon, and then we don't get any of the money unless we make our goal, which, like I said, is $10,000. So.
And your website in the tote, maybe you could spell that out for people who are not familiar with the reference there.
It's www.inthetote. Mm-hmm. And a fish tote is where fish are stored as they're awaiting processing after we deliver them on the dock. And so this is where our work is stored. And so, it's inthetote.com, inthetote.com.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
And one aspect of this you referred to also was the fact that there's not only poetry in this collection, there are prose pieces. And I think right now we have time to hear one of the prose pieces that's in the volume the volume that's titled, it's the one on the environment, right, Chelsea? The one that Victoria Stapiello has?
Illusions of Separateness.
Illusions of Separateness.
Yeah. And so Victoria Stapiello, who has just been our interim station manager, who lives on the coast, has a piece called Salmon in Cans in that volume. And we're going to hear Victoria reading that we recorded her a few days ago reading that selection. So
wonderful.
Let's go to that now.
This is probably the first essay I ever wrote for publication, and it comes from the fact that my husband and I moved into the house that my dad was born in Ilwaco, Washington, which used to be the premier salmon fishing port in the Northwest. And we moved there in 1993, and the town was really on hard times because, of course, logging had already pretty much come to an end, and fishing was deteriorating at a rapid clip. The name of this essay is Salmon in Cans, and it was first published in the Chinook Observer, which is the newspaper of record for Pacific County, Washington. It's owned by the East Oregonian Publishing Company, whom I have to salute because they publish about 8 community newspapers, and they have really strong editorial policies. I used to say that the Astorian reported the environment the way the Oregonian reports crime.
I just want to make sure
essay
our mics
is
rough.
Called Salmon and Cans. My dad was a commercial fisherman. He ran a troller, the Sally, out of Ilwaco, Washington, most of his life. His father before him was a fisherman too, a gillnetter. I remember what I refer to as the last salmon that my dad brought me when I was still living in Portland. It was a silver, rightly called a coho, and didn't seem that big. That was in the early 1980s. Fishing was already bad then. My dad sold his boat and his commercial license not long afterward. Fish have been a big part of my family life, going to the Mager docks with my maternal grandpa to buy sturgeon, extended family meals centered on fish head stew or a big salmon roast, or fried sturgeon or smelt grilled on the basement wood cook stove. Those days are gone. My husband, on the other hand, is an architect, not a fisherman. But when we're out walking and he sees a discarded aluminum can, he exclaims, "Hey, another smolt," and puts it in his pocket. He's been involved in the politics of energy for a long time. When he sees aluminum lying around on the ground, he equates it with the fish that are killed by the hydroelectric dams. Yeah, a lot of people think the fish ought to do all right going up the fish ladders, and they do. It's the young fish, the smolts, coming downstream that the dams really kill. It's estimated that 90% of the smolts headed for the sea are ground up by the turbines in one dam or another, and the rest are put at risk by the intense turbulence going over the spillways. What does this have to do with aluminum cans? Well, the aluminum industry has been heavily subsidized by cheap electric power provided by the Bonneville Power Administration's dam system. We all benefit from this subsidized power. We in the Northwest pay about half the rate compared with the rest of the United States for our electricity. But the aluminum industry received an even bigger subsidy, paying less for a kilowatt hour than a household would. The amount they bought accounted for 25% of BPA's revenue, which, when you think it through, means aluminum manufacturing was using more than 25% of BPA's output. One dam on the Columbia was built just for aluminum production. But the company realized they could make even more money by reselling that cheap power rather than using it to manufacture a product. Today, that cheap power is used for giant internet servers in Central Oregon, meaning every email, every like on Facebook has an impact on salmon runs. This is what the environmentalists are talking about when they refer to externalities. Externalities are the hidden environmental and social costs of a particular industry or course of action. But hardly anyone wants to pay that bill. It's easier to avoid responsibility. Recycling appears to be low-hanging fruit on the environmental tree, but with aluminum, it makes a major impact because it takes 1/20th of the electricity to make a can from recycled aluminum, rather than from virgin material. In other words, if it took a dollar's worth of electricity to make one can, it would take only 5 cents to make a can from recycled stuff. There are things we can do. We can turn off that monitor, insulate our house, turn off the lights when we leave the room. We can lower the thermostat and dry our laundry outside rather than using an electric dryer. We can set an example of conservation for the rest of society. After all, fishermen and tribes are giving up their livelihoods in an effort to save salmon runs. My husband stopped eating salmon a few years ago. He didn't want to eat one of the last of an endangered species. But a while back, we opened a jar of salmon that my dad had canned. It made a nice meal and was food for thought. I'm not a native. I'm not a Chinook or a Umatilla, but I too see salmon as more than food for the body. I was lucky enough to see the fishing at Celilo Falls when I was a kid. There have been suggestions that we take down a number of small dams in the Northwest in order to save salmon runs. I'd go further. I'd like to take down the Dalles Dam. I'd like to see Celilo Falls again.
And that was Victoria Stoppiello reading her essay that's included in this anthology, this Fisher Poets anthology that we've been talking about on Between the Covers. Her essay is called Salmon in Cans. And in the last minutes of this interview, let's talk about interviews that are within this anthology. Chelsea, you said that was important to you to have interviews in each volume. Why was that?
I feel like it really brought out the personal nature of this project because it was both personal for me and I think it's really personal for everybody involved. I also, when I go to these Fisher Poet gatherings, I'm not a fisherman, but I have an overwhelming sense of being involved and included, and just this immediate connection with this community of folks. They're really inviting and welcoming, and I just wanted to share that side with a wider audience, just allow people to get to know them a little bit better.
And one of the interviews in one of the volumes is with the founder of the Fisher Poet Gathering.
Mm-hmm. John Broderick.
Tell us a little bit about that interview.
It was a little intimidating. He is the founder. He's one of the most humble people you will ever meet. He's not really one to jump up and say he's founded and started this whole gathering. In fact, he's quicker to say that it's just been a group effort, which indeed it has been. Yeah. But he's a pretty remarkable guy. He's been fishing with his family since the beginning. He actually started fishing with his wife, and then they had kids, and he's brought them in. And he also gives them the freedom to choose what they want to do with their life. So they fish with him, but they're also kind of mapping out their own futures for themselves. And he doesn't know whether or not they'll be fishing the rest of their life or going a different route. But the stories about connecting with his family through fishing are quite beautiful.
So Pat Dixon, do you want to reiterate how people can get information about this project?
Sure. We are not live with the Kickstarter campaign yet. We intend on being live and launching the campaign next week, and it'll be a 60-day campaign, and we're going to announce it on www.fisherpoets.org. We're going to announce it on the Fisher Poet Gathering Facebook page, and we're going to announce it on www.inthetote.com. And so anybody that's interested, and In the Tote already has a page set up so you can see a little bit more about what it's about and actually view the covers that Chelsea designed that are so beautiful. As a last thing, if I've got a minute.
About 20 seconds.
20 seconds. I just would like to say that one of the things that motivated us, and I think that this has become for us, is a way of preserving the culture of fisher poetry and commercial fishing. And so, and I'd also like to thank Mo Baustern for being out there and listening to us, mm-hmm. and texting us during the show.
Hi, Mo.
and she'll be on soon talking about her latest project. Yeah. This has been Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. We've been speaking with Chelsea Stephen, illustrator and Fisher poet, photographer, and writer Patrick Dixon about their anthology, the Fisher Poets Anthology, Anchored in Deep Water. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Black Book Talk.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX Fusion Winter Event, Words. Words will take place Saturday, March 8th at 8:30 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne. PDX Fusion celebrates the collaboration between different modalities of expression. Words will feature multiple different performers, visual and interactive art, and a short presentation on creating social change through body-centered communication. That's Words, hosted by PDX Fusion, on Saturday, March 8th at the Analog Cafe. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning, and welcome to the March edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch.
And this is O.B. Hill.
And we are happy to welcome to the program this morning Stephen Hinks, who is the author of The Achy Tree, A Descendant's Quest for His Slave Ancestors on the Eskridge Plantation. Boy, I can't talk today. It must be the prospect of spring is making me excited. But Stephen, welcome to Black Book Talk, and tell us about this, because it took you a little bit farther than an American plantation to trace your family's history.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very excited to be on the program. And let me just start off. I want to apologize at first. I'm just getting over a cold, so if I get a little tickle and a little cough, you'll know ahead of time. But, yeah, this project started way back in 1989, and I didn't know anything about my father's side of the family. And one day he got a letter in the mail from his cousin from back in Manhattan, Kansas, dad's hometown, and it was a funeral announcement of one of his close cousins had died, and he was the first black mayor of Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State University, Merd Hanks Jr., deceased. So that just started me on this quest. I wanted to know just my relatives on my father's side. I never met his parents. They passed away before I was born. He had a brother. He passed away when I was 1 month old, so I never did connect it, my dad's family. So that's kind of how the project started out in 1989, just trying to learn about his people. And as the more I kept digging, the more I kept going further, and I was saying, wow, if I keep doing this, I may be able to go, who knows how far back I can go. So that's how it got started.
Okay, our third co-host is joining us.
Good morning. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, and I'm glad to be here.
It was just one of those days, yes. More rain than usual.
Wow, this is a very interesting episode in your life. You worked on this for quite a while. Now, what prompted you to get interested in this particular area?
Well, as you know, Obi, and we met for the first time several years back at a genealogy, I think it was a seminar or conference for the Genealogical Forum of Oregon. And, I just wanted to just know about my relatives. That's basically what it was. I knew a lot about my mother's side of the family. I had cousins here in Portland, Oregon, but never connected with my folks on my dad's side. So that's how it got started. And then, of course, the movie Roots, and